Good evening and welcome to the April 16th meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. We'll start, as always, with introductions, starting with Commissioner Swenson.
Jim Swenson, South Kitsap.
Rich Shattuck, Central Kitsap.
Kim Allen, South Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Shelley Kniep, South Kitsap.
Okay. And we have three commissioners absent this evening. So moving on to item B, adoption of agenda. Do we have a motion to adopt the agenda as presented?
Move to adopt the agenda.
I'll second.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by raising your hand. All those opposed? And it passes unanimously. All right, moving on to approval of minutes. I have a note here that the March minutes we're going to postpone to the next meeting. So we'll take up a motion for approval of the February 19th, 2019 minutes. Do we have a motion?
Move to approve the February 19th minutes of meeting.
Second.
Any discussion, edits, adds to the minutes? All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by raising your hand. Opposed? And it passes unanimously. Moving on to item D. This is our 2018 Planning Commission Annual Report. Dave Ward is with us today. Pardon my voice. I sound terrible. I don't feel as bad as I sound.
Sounds like maybe you should have stayed home, too.
I'm at the tail end of something, but I'm just waiting for my voice to come back. Oh, so good. My goal tonight is to speak as little as possible.
Good. So for your review and approval, we have the draft annual report from last year. You should have had that in your packets after our mix-up last time. So the report is pretty much the same, the exact same format as last year's. The introductory language is identical. The slate of Planning Commission members has been updated. Key actions taken in 2018, that section has been updated to reflect the 2018 activities. And then the chronological summary was basically actions of the commission that were pulled from the meeting minutes. So are there any changes or edits?
Any other feedback from Mr. Ward? I think we're good to go.
Well, that was
Do you need a motion or a vote? Or
I think we need a vote to approve them, and then usually the next step after this is that we will work with Amanda to get a meeting scheduled with the Board of County Commissioners for discussion and review.
Okay. We'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve the draft report.
Second. Do we have a second? Second. Mr. Shattuck. Any other discussion? All those in favor of approving the report signify by saying, or raising your hand.
I'm not sure if I should abstain. I mean, I report looked fine, but I was not a member during 2018, so I couldn't vouch for anything on it.
Okay, we'll offer that option then.
We did all those our best opposed, not to lie.
None opposed. All those abstaining? One. And you have your direction.
Okay, we will get you a final version of this without draft stamped all over it before the meeting with the commissioners.
All right, next up we have item E of our agenda, which is findings of fact, wireless code update. Darren Gurney is our staff on this. Darren, do you want to kind of tee this up for us?
So this is somewhat of a formality. We are going through findings of fact this evening. If you recall, we had three work studies, public hearing, a large amount of testimony from that public hearing, responses, new draft, and finally a recommended draft from the Planning Commission through unanimous vote. The executive summary provided you the attachments for the findings of fact and the recommended draft from the Planning Commission. You should have those before you. We incorporated the comments that the Planning Commission requested at the last meeting, and they are here for your review, and I'm ready to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner Nevins.
Yes, I have a question. On item number 22 on the findings of fact, I believe it is, findings of fact, attachment D. Two things. First, I don't recall, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen, that the Planning Commission recommends that we hold a shareholder meeting. But the second part says that we also, that number 23, that Kitsap County Planning Commission requests a report to the Planning Commission at the next applicable meeting. Now, did any of those things happen?
The meeting has occurred. We do not have a report out from that meeting. That was, we anticipated being more of a verbal report back to the Planning Commission, in addition to any differences between Planning Commission draft and what goes to the board. So we're still in the process of digesting that and drafting what will go to the board.
Could you tell me who attended that meeting on behalf of staff?
On behalf of staff?
Yeah.
So we had Scott Diener, Dave Ward, myself. From the Parks Department, we had Trevor Buell. I'm drawing a blank here. Don't have my cheat sheet with me.
I didn't mean to make it a pop quiz.
John Brand from Public Works. And we had several of the wireless industry representatives there as well. Someone from the Kitsap Public Utility District, Puget Sound Energy.
So Mr. Ward, is it, am I hearing that you're still digesting and perhaps evaluating the draft that will go to the board?
Yes, we don't have the final version that will go to the board just yet.
Okay. Okay, so I'm just thinking procedurally where that lands us. We're recommending the draft that you have, but there may be changes made. How would we know what those were, or will you circulate those to the Planning Commission?
Yeah, the draft that goes back to the board we will report back to this commission on the draft that goes back to the board and any differences between that draft and the draft that the Planning Commission has recommended.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
We want to keep you in the loop.
We'd like to be in the loop. Are there other questions or comments?
So the findings of fact we're approving tonight are what's here, right. And so whatever changes are made after this, there's no finding of fact recommending adoption of those. Just procedurally, if that's all right, I'm comfortable with that approach, but I'm a little surprised. It's kind of like writing a blank check. And
that's kind of normal in a way that we make a recommendation to DCD and things.
Mr.
Go
Nevins, can you angle your
comes out somewhere mic. Or another.
You need to move the microphone closer.
Okay. I can do that. So I don't find it terribly different from what normally goes on. We never make the final decision anyways.
So do you anticipate that the Planning Commission's findings of fact you'll present to the board, and any changes you think might be appropriate due to this meeting, you would present as an alternate both for the board to consider, Board of Commissioners?
So, for the record, Jim Bulger, Department of Community Development. Typically, when we've done something like this where we've made modifications from a Planning Commission draft, we'll usually reflect that to the board in some kind of a matrix where they'll see the Planning Commission recommendation and the staff recommendation, where it differs or where there's concurrence. And so we will do exactly as you say, Commissioner, that we would present the findings of fact in the Planning Commission version. Then there'd be a staff recommended version that would reflect any of the changes that come along between findings of fact and the board's consideration.
And that's in line with what you were saying, and I think with the statute as well.
Yeah. So, Mr. Bolger, is it possible for us to get a copy of that at the same time you put the packet out to the board or in advance of that?
Oh, absolutely. We can make sure you get a copy of that.
Okay. Right. Are there other issues, Mr. Spence? No?
I do have a question on just the redlining. You noted in a comment where it was a planning commission change. Are there any other? I mean, there's still other things that are redlined that aren't.
Yes, so in that draft, the red lines were identifying the differences between the original proposal, which was the first attachment. Okay. The red lines were identified for the later version that was adopted by Planning Commission, and it identified specifically Planning Commission-based motions
okay.
made that change.
But they're not something we didn't see yet?
No, they are not. They were in the attachment, I believe, C5. The one that was actually moved forward.
Other questions? Well, I have an issue with finding number 24. In that finding, we're attesting that the proposed amendment to the Kitsap County Code is consistent with federal standards, and I'm not sure that the draft as proposed is there yet. I have several areas of concern where I think that haven't become compliant with the FCC order. So, and I've laid those out in a minority report that I'm happy to submit and distribute to everybody to show my areas of concern. I wanted to throw that out for everybody.
I'm not uncomfortable with that statement because basically the federal standards are shifting. Every time we think they're going one direction, the FCC comes up with new rules. So to say that our code is consistent with the standards right now, I believe it is. If the standards federal change their standards, well, that happens. And like we discussed earlier, I mean, anybody can start to pick apart those codes and, you know, poke holes into it to say that, no, it isn't consistent.
Any thoughts?
So my response to that is that there are areas of the federal rules that do have a certain amount of ambiguity to them and are subject to interpretation. We have to rely on the county's legal counsel to advise us on this, and that's exactly what we've done.
I understand. Yeah. Mr. Shattuck?
Well, is that finding necessary? If we don't find this body it's consistent with federal standards and just strike that, it's consistent with the GMA and the rest of it, is that going to leave some kind of a legal difficulty?
After discussion with our legal counsel, it will not make or break the case for the findings of fact. As the Planning Commission is not interpreting law, it does not have to be in the findings of fact.
Right. And we will the chair entertain an amendment to strike that those two words in finding of fact number 24 from these findings before approval?
Federal standards.
Two words, strike the words federal standards from finding 24 before it's adopted. I would move that the words federal standards be stricken from finding of fact 24.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right, all those in favor of striking the words federal standards from finding 24, signify by raising your hand. Opposed? And it passes. It passes 5-1.
That brings up a question. If someone wanted to challenge this ordinance, would they challenge it through the Growth Management Hearings Board as a development regulation, or is there any kind of FCC appeal process? If somebody was saying it was inconsistent with the FCC orders? Does anybody know?
This is a federal court. You have an action in federal court under the Telecommunications Act.
But then there's also the parallel state. So would that also be, I've seen actions filed in both. So maybe that's what would happen.
This is a development regulation.
Yeah. All right. Any other discussion on the findings of fact as amended? All right. Then I'll entertain a motion to approve the findings of fact as amended.
I move we approve the findings of fact as amended.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by raising your hand. Opposed? And it passes unanimously. Right. Moving on to item F, work study, high-risk secured facilities ordinance. Liz Williams is at the table, as is Mr. Ward, Mr. Bulger. And
the whole gang is here. All right. Thank you.
As I understand it, this is a briefing, a work study, a question and answer. A public hearing is yet to come.
Yep, exactly. So, for the record, my name is Liz Williams. I'm a planner with the Department of Community Development. Tonight we're here to hold a work study session with the Planning Commission regarding proposed amendments to the interim zoning ordinance that was adopted by the board on February 6th. I wanted to note that the interim zoning ordinance regulates group residential facilities secured high risk, but the department is proposing to change the name of the use to high risk secured facilities. Based on public feedback, so I just wanted to make that note so as we move forward, you'll hear it referred to as high-risk secured facilities. So I'm going to start out the work study tonight by giving a brief presentation that will cover what a high-risk secured facility is, a summary of the ordinance, and where proposed facilities may be currently allowed in unincorporated Kitsap County, an outline of the process moving forward, and opportunities for the public to participate and stay informed, and an overview of the county's limitations under state law. After the presentation, we can review the proposed code language found in Attachment A of your packet and do our best to answer any questions that the Planning Commission has at this time. Does that sound like a good game plan?
Perfect.
So a high-risk secured facility houses two or more civilly committed sexually violent predators or persons that pose a likelihood of serious harm to others. These individuals have completed their criminal sentence and have petitioned Superior Court to be conditionally released from a state-operated facility to a community-based facility to receive ongoing treatment and supervision. There's a long history that has led to the use of community-based facilities, which is briefly outlined in the slide above and in greater detail in your staff reports. In short, state law requires cities and counties to allow these facilities and provides limited guidance for their placement in local communities. The proposed amendment defines these facilities in Kitsap County Code. The ordinance also identifies specific neighborhood compatibility and safety requirements, such as requiring an automatic fire sprinkler system and backup power in case of a power outage. The ordinance also requires Kitsap County to mail notification to the school district and landowners within a half mile of proposed facilities, which is consistent with the Sheriff's Office community notification standards. It also requires the county to hold a neighborhood meeting before processing a permit application and hold a public hearing during the permit review process. So the ordinance currently allows this use to be proposed in the commercial and industrial zones listed on the slide above. These zones are in urban areas and provide a higher level of service, such as access to police, fire, and emergency management services. The ordinance also establishes additional siting restrictions allowed under state law. A facility cannot be located within 880 feet from a public and private school. In addition, a facility cannot be located adjacent to, across the street from, or within the line of sight of a risk potential activity or facility, which are again listed up on the screen. So moving forward, the board has 6 months under state law to adopt a final ordinance unless a work plan is approved. The feedback received at the board public hearing on March 25th, tonight's work study session with the Planning Commission and coordination with local jurisdictions will be used to shape the final draft ordinance for the board, Planning Commission, and public to consider. The Planning Commission is tentatively scheduled to hold a second public hearing on May 7th and make a recommendation to the department by early June. The board is tentatively scheduled to review the draft final ordinance in May, hold a third public hearing on June 24th, and then take final action on the final ordinance in July ahead of the August 6th deadline. The public will have the opportunity to provide public comment either online, in writing to the county, or at one of the scheduled public hearings. The public is encouraged to stay involved throughout the process by visiting the Kitsap County Code Updates website, where we have information about the process, all of the relevant materials related to it. They can also subscribe to the county's GovDelivery electronic notification system by selecting the Kitsap County Code Update announcement list, or by contacting the Department of Community Development with any questions they might have. So as the Planning Commission reviews the proposed code amendment and receives public testimony on May 7th, there are certain limitations under state law that Kitsap County can and cannot regulate. For example, Kitsap County cannot regulate facility operations, such as the number of staff, staff training requirements, or outings in the community. However, Kitsap County can regulate neighborhood compatibility and safety, which include who receives community notification, the zones where facilities can be proposed, and building safety requirements. With that, I recommend we review the draft code, and then, as I mentioned, the department will do our best to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Does anyone have any broad? I have a broad question.
Sure, sure, sure.
On one of those elements, there, on the last slide before.
Last slide. Yeah. Okay. Oops. This one here.
I'm looking at Kitsap County cannot regulate separation distances from certain facilities beyond what's allowed in state law. Can you regulate separation distances from certain uses or zones, as opposed to identified facilities? Like a certain setback from a residential zone. I mean, I'm envisioning a commercial zone that abuts a residential zone. You know, if you could, is that possible under state law?
It's our understanding right now, based on legal counsel, that is not something that we can do regulate under state law as it exists today.
Thank you.
Yep. And I would add that as a practical matter, that could get very, very difficult. Because it could result, because of the way residential uses are distributed across the zones, it could result in a de facto moratorium. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Is this the very first facility on Viking Way? Is that the only one in Kitsap County that has been established so far?
Our understanding that in unincorporated Kitsap County, it is the only facility that has been established.
However, there may be some in cities?
Correct. And okay. There are also potential placements within a residential home, so with a family member, that this ordinance would not regulate those types of situations.
And there are placements of folks who have been deemed sexually violent predators who have been released to less restrictive alternatives in the county, but not in a group setting like that.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is the Viking Way facility is not a legally established facility.
That is currently, the department has issued a notice of violation to the property owner. That has been appealed and will go to the hearing examiner, I believe, on May 23rd.
Yep. So basically, this code only addresses the high risk restricted facilities. Restricted being that the person is restricted to that facility.
There's, as we've learned quite a bit over the last several months on this topic, these folks are released by court orders out of Superior Court, and there can be a number of conditions applied. And so you kind of have this spectrum in terms of the level of enhanced security and services that these individuals are required to adhere to. In this particular case, it's considered more of an enhanced service facility and is more restrictive than maybe some of the other currently placed individuals in the county or in other locations in other counties around the state.
Right. But the code is only addressing this type of facility.
Correct.
We're not addressing placement of predators in the community and all the other things that happen that the sheriff is.
You mean like other sexual offenders who have been released into the community? No, this is only, we do know that there are situations where landlords have rented out rooms to folks who have come served their criminal commitments or confinement and then are released back in. They may still be under some level of Department of Corrections supervision, say probation or something to that effect, but they're no longer considered under confinement the way these individuals are placed by the courts.
One of the things that distinguishes the placements in these types of facilities is that most of the people who are there by nature of some sort of mental handicap. And for example, one of the people who was placed in the Viking Way facility is described by his counsel as having an IQ of 68. So the people in the group facilities typically are relying on a broad array of support services and counseling services, and they're for the most part not really able to function in normal society independently.
So as I read it, these are typically they're generally locked facilities. The residents would be supervised when they were out in the community. Is that right?
In reading the court orders for these placements, whether the facility itself is on a lockdown or whether it's other electronic surveillance, that can vary. But yes, they are not free to roam about at will outside of the facility. If they do, they require they have to petition the court in order to get permission to do so, but they also have to have an escort with them at all times, and that applies to all excursions out of the facility, including a trip to the grocery store or to go to do their periodic reporting to the sheriff's department or anything else.
I was just curious. I mean, like Jim was saying, we learn a lot by being on the Planning Commission and being on the Department of Community Development that we never really intended to learn.
Likewise.
And one of the things I learned was that in connection with the one we just passed, the wireless code, where the FCC says we cannot adopt a code that materially inhibits the performance. And I'm curious if this limitation on commercial and industrial areas and proximity to various things like residences, et cetera, and requiring a conditional use permit for each is presents a problem that in the line of, although the Department of Corrections has not said you cannot materially inhibit this. This code, as I read it, seems to be pretty limited as to where you can place a facility. I'm curious how those zones were decided upon, and what was the process that you went through?
Yeah.
So can I let you talk to that latter part?
Sure.
But first, I just want to kind of give more of kind of a policy consideration that the department is making as we propose this code. It is very much kind of we're walking a thin line. We do have other instances where the state has exempted any local control over some of the placements of facilities. One example would be an adult family home. That's allowed in all of our zones. This is an instance where the county is exercising some control, but we also want to be careful that we're not so restrictive that the state could come in and basically say, look at all counties and cities, you no longer have any authority that you can exercise in terms of the placement of these facilities or the size or the service or what have you. And so we've been working with the cities in the county. We've had a lot of ongoing communication, particularly at a staff level. Politically, it gets a little, more robust in terms of opinions on these. But at a staff level, I think there's a real interest in making sure that across our jurisdictional boundaries that we're trying to be relatively consistent so that we don't put one community at a disadvantage for the potential placement of these facilities over another. I think that what you see before you and what Liz can talk about in terms of these zones that are currently allowed is an active conversation that is going on with the other cities right now.
Yeah.
And we're hearing from the public and have heard from the public about maybe additional limitations that might be considered as well. So this is one where we know it's a sensitive topic and we need to move carefully. We had several bills that were in the legislature this session. I haven't moved forward at this point, and I doubt they will, but certainly the state is and other communities are becoming sensitized to this placement of these types of facilities. So Liz, if you want to jump
sure.
in.
So the specific zones that we proposed to the board initially were based on a review of surrounding local jurisdictions. So in your packets, there was a summary of a comparison of similar uses, which kind of pointed out where different jurisdictions allowed these uses. And typically they are within the commercial or industrial zones. Some communities do allow more these facilities to be located in more zones. And we have done a preliminary review to look at how much of those zones may be restricted based on the buffer requirements and those facilities. And just to give you, just a real high level, in the commercial zone, based on the buffers, about 11% of the area would be restricted based on those buffer requirements. And then in the industrial and regional center zones, it raises to about 20% of the area of those zones being restricted based on the buffer requirements. So it does limit, and it's really to ensure neighborhood compatibility is the other reason for the zones that were selected.
Just another comment going back to learning things you didn't intend to learn. This whole exercise was brought about by the fact that the state made the placement but did not inform the county, and the community found out about it and got excited. And they have fears, and the fear is real. I mean, they definitely feel the fear. But unfortunately, one of the things I learned is that we have a much bigger problem than controlling the people who are in these homes. That sexual predators are doing bad things throughout the county, and the propensity to do things like are very bad. But somehow the community doesn't really think about that so much. And my reading of the whole situation was that the people who are in custody of these high security areas are probably less danger than the 99% of sexual offenders who are outside of the system. Now, is there any way that the county has entertained the concept of educating folks how big the problem is and how maybe this is a good solution
I think one of the things and one of the requirements in the placement of these is the neighborhood meeting. And I think that's an opportunity to kind of really kind of promote information. I think the commissioners have also been pretty outspoken, at least in the hearing on the 25th and in other forums that I've attended where they've been there, where they really are. I mean, this is a interesting question of justice in our communities, really. And I think one of the things that they're really interested in at the commissioner level is making sure that if this truly is a situation where the state is trying to place these people back in the communities from which they came, I mean, I think that's the overall goal of Department of Social and Health Services, is that if they're going to do that, that has to be a partnership with the communities. And so we need to have better upfront communication with the state agencies rather than having a situation like we ran into, so that if before one of these facilities gets located within or the release of a particularly violent person who's not held in civil confinement is being released, that the communities are notified ahead of time so that we can take action, we can start having some of those kind of conversations in our communities to really address those fears and concerns that in some instances may be just kind of perceptions and not necessarily the realities.
Well, I would echo Tom's opinion about, it seems to me we're focused on this type of secured facility which presents less risk to the community than what the program, the corrections program, is doing all the time, which is putting people of various risk levels into the community.
And then you start getting into fair housing issues, which is a, you know, which is one of the big concerns, I think, for advocates for moving these people back out, and any limitations being placed on them is really from a kind of a fair access to housing standpoint. And so that's one of the reasons why folks who have effectively served their sentences, you know, we can't restrict, as a local jurisdiction, we can't restrict where those people can live. We do see kind of clusters of them in certain communities. We also see a high population, I think, in the homeless community of these folks because they can't find housing in other locations as well, which is probably the worst situation that these folks can find themselves in.
Well, I think that, you know, I agree with what my colleagues have said. I think if there are any statistical analyses of rates of offending in this type of a facility versus, you know, the community at large, I think those types of comparisons might be a helpful tool at these neighborhood meetings to actually put some data in front of people and make the case that this facility may be, you know, a safer bet than just a general release into the community of people that need this type of assistance.
Yeah, and I don't disagree. I think that's a really hard message to communicate effectively because I think people's fear kind of sometimes blocks their comprehension of kind of the broader perspective on it. And at least that's been the experience I've had at any of the public meetings I've participated in.
Well, just in the information realm, do we have statistics based on the number of predators or sex offenders that have been released into the community that have gone ahead and recommitted?
I don't have that
information. I don't have that information at this
and
time.
And I ask that based on we want to know if this type of facility has had issues. Well, we should also know what the program at large is doing so that people understand, you know, where the real risk is coming from in that.
So we have not been able to get those kinds of numbers from corrections or from DSHS. When Liz has reached out to DSHS, we received what I would describe as a very carefully worded response, because I think they recognize that this is a very challenging issue for the state, because the state is basically running this program as a result of a constitutional challenge. And so in crafting the language that the department is recommending at this point, we are between what I would describe as a somewhat convoluted and hard to decipher set of state code, the constitutional issues, and the recognition that these people have served their sentences, but they are still not in a position where they can function independently in society. But they still deserve a place to live, you know, from a constitutional issue. So, it gets into the right to housing. It gets into questions of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and this code is, I would describe it as kind of trying to thread a needle with a piece of yarn. We hit something no matter where we go.
Okay, on to the specifics of the code. With that,
I'm gonna say, yeah. Where were we?
I don't know that you answered the question about how these zones were chosen.
So they were chosen based on a review of the surrounding jurisdictions. Yep. So I'm happy to walk through section by section if you'd like me to, just to kind of give you the high-level notes on what is different between the interim regulations that were adopted by the board and then this draft code. And then if there's any specific questions you have about any of the sections, we can dive into those as we go. Does that sound good? All right, so the first section of the draft ordinance essentially is the definition. So from this, the differences between the interim regulations that are in place currently and the proposed amendments, the current interim regulations limit the occupants of the facilities to no more than four. The proposed definition moving forward now does not restrict the number of occupants, and it essentially says two or more persons that have been placed by the court. The other thing we did was incorporate in some facilities that are considered essential public facilities under the Growth Management Act. So there's what are known as secure community transition facilities, which are typically state-operated facilities, of which there are two in Washington State, one on McNeil Island and then one in King County. And then also looking at nursing homes, assisted living facilities, or adult family homes that have become licensed as enhanced service facilities. So those are a specific license required under state law for those types of facilities. Moving on, Section 3 essentially establishes the new land use, which is Categorical Use 127. And that is located on, I've got the page number for you specifically, page 2 of Attachment A. And again, allows it in the zones that we've talked about to date through a conditional use permit process. And then don't look at the screen if you don't like scrolling. Get through all the use table.
Kitsap County has one of the longest use tables I've ever seen.
Well, we broke it into three sections, so it's not as long as it used to be. And then section 4 on page 8, thank you. Essentially sets out some specific special provisions for this use. So this is where you're going to find page 19. Thank you, Dave. That work is nice. It's wood.
Almost there. There's something about a cabaret.
Yeah. These are all
there's
of our
some
special
other unusual things in there too.
Special uses. So this section of the code establishes that, you know, the county has to hold a neighborhood meeting, that we must mail notification to the school district and landowners within the half-mile radius, and then talks about the high-risk facilities and activities that were mentioned and restricting this use from being located adjacent to, immediately across the street, or parking lot from, or within line of sight of the facilities that are listed below here. And then it also restricts the facilities from being located within the community protection zone, which is that 880-foot distance from public and private schools. It does require the use to meet all applicable health district standards for water and sewage disposal to account for both staff and residents of the facilities. Requires principal access to the site from a county-maintained right-of-way. This provision is specifically to ensure that there is access in case of an emergency, and also to mitigate any impacts of traffic generated from a facility on a private easement road. It also requires that facilities be equipped with automatic fire sprinkler systems, to also require that there is a mechanism that is interlocked with the fire protection system to automatically release any security locks and allow for safe egress from the structure in the event of a fire or other emergency. So this is really to protect the occupants of the facility and ensure that they have the ability to leave in case of an emergency. And it also requires backup power in case of a power outage. So because there are requirements to have security systems in place by these court orders requiring that the facility have that backup power generation to ensure that the facilities continue to operate as required.
Liz, could you scroll back up? I have a question about the protected zone.
Yeah.
Is school defined in here?
So
does it include daycares, things like that?
So it's only public and private schools. Daycares does not fall within that definition.
So those protection zones are defined by the state, and so in state RCW, they do define what they mean. And so a school, like a learning center, a tutoring center, like a Sylvan's Learning Center, to use kind of a brand name, that would qualify as a private school, but a licensed daycare or preschool does not fall within the definition.
And the flip side of that is, do grandfathering rules protect the high-risk facility? I mean, yes. If I wanted to locate my school within 880 feet of, they're still okay, right? Yeah.
Right. So it's facilities in place at the time of the this high-risk secured facility being established.
And I noticed both in state law and in this code, they talk about some line of sight or some distance from a school bus stop. Mm-hmm. When I first moved into my house, there was a school bus stop nearby. But then for a decade, there wasn't. Mm-hmm. And now there is again.
Right. Yeah. Again, it's at the time of establishment of the facility that would be evaluated.
I have a question about the fire sprinkler system. Is that standard in other like facilities?
So it's our understanding, based on building code, whenever the occupants of a facility's liberties are restricted, it falls into a different classification of building code. So that it falls into the institutional building code standard. And so because these occupants are restricted in terms of their liberties by court order, that's where that provision is coming from.
This is these facilities, you can kind of think of them almost as de facto jails. People don't necessarily have liberties. And any jail, if it was built from scratch, would have requirements for fire-resistive construction and for fire suppression. When these facilities are established in something that was constructed as a single-family home, it doesn't necessarily have those kinds of life safety features.
So they would have to retrofit it?
Yes.
And then if there's no other questions about the special provisions, the final section of code that would be amended is our neighborhood meeting requirements found in Section 2104. 130 of Kitsap County Code. And essentially what this is prior to the interim regulations being adopted, neighborhood meetings were predominantly optional for all types of applications. So we went through and clarified that for this facility or this land use, and also for certain cases, transitory accommodations are required to hold a neighborhood meeting. So this section just makes that clear for folks that would be applying for a proposed facility. And that's really the ordinance in a nutshell.
Yeah, can you scroll down to that sub 5 under there? Is a new provision. I don't know what you mean by it.
So the description. So everything in the existing neighborhood meeting requirements talks about issues and problems that cannot be addressed. So we also added a description of project support raised by the neighborhood during the meeting.
A short section.
Well, we did receive testimony of people who have been supportive of these facilities because they realize, you know, you have to figure something out with this.
And also, if someone was holding an optional neighborhood meeting, this would be something that would be valuable in that regard as well, because it would allow for, you know, the project applicant to basically display in their summary report, you know, what project support they did receive for that.
Just a curiosity. Congratulations on the work with putting all the comments together and addressing them in groups rather than one by one. I'm just curious if there's been any communication that has come forward that indicates a little better level of acceptance by certain cities, mayors that have been addressed by your letters, or do we still have strong opposition?
So there are some planned meetings for further discussions between the county and the city, both at the elected official level, and as I mentioned before, we're meeting with their staff to make sure that we have consistency across. Port Orchard, last week in their city council meeting, they adopted an interim ordinance that effectively mirrors what Kitsap County has adopted. We have amendments to Bremerton's code moving forward that we're not totally in line with, where they do want to put some provisions in there that kind of limit the distance for locating these relative to any kind of residential structures, even if it's in one of the allowable zones. We're not sure if that's really feasible from a legal perspective. And then I think Polsbo is scheduled to take action here shortly, also with some interim measures as well. So we're trying to, as I said before, kind of make sure that we're collaborating and communicating with the other jurisdictions at all levels as much as we can.
So the request that we repeal the interim ordinance and put a moratorium on is not moving forward?
That is not going to happen. In fact, some of the jurisdictions who had previously been considering moratoriums while they worked through this, I think based on conversations with us and the legal analysis that we've been able to compile, have kind of had second thoughts and gone more towards an interim zoning approach rather than a straight out moratorium. And this, again, is, you know, even if one of us goes too far, we don't want to bring the state down and say, okay, everybody out of the pool.
Is the state
That's
involved?
Not a planning term.
Is the state involved in commenting? And
we haven't received any comments from them at this point. We're assuming we may hear something from them. There has been some activity, as Liz mentioned. There was an appeal on the notice of violation that will go before the hearing examiner. There's also been some activity around some of the placements who are, I think, going back to the Superior Court, trying to look at potential options for additional orders that the court may be able to issue in terms of their current placement. And so there's still a lot of kind of plates spinning.
We have reached out to the state departments and have gotten what I would describe as a somewhat limited and cautiously worded response.
What about Commerce? Is it still called Commerce
Department? Yeah, we did we did the required notifications to Commerce related to the interim regulations that were adopted, and we'll also share this with them as part of their notification requirements.
But they don't have any guidelines or
no
any opinions on
that I'm aware of at this time.
Is there a CEPA review?
Yes, there is a CEPA review.
Yes, and you know, Liz described at the beginning in her presentation how this started back in the 90s with constitutional challenges, and this has led to a whole series of activity at the state level that has kind of led to a state code regarding these issues that is kind of a boxcar or a sidecar approach. You know, there are just different clumps of code that are appearing in different places. It is quite difficult to decipher that, and from what we've seen so far, this is still evolving in the minds of, you know, the people in the respective departments.
So are these facilities relatively new? I mean, are they starting to occur more frequently in cities and counties? Or
we are starting to see this more frequently, largely because the state is under pressure to move some of these people out of facilities like McNeil, but also because many of the placements that they've made to date have been in Pierce County in the vicinity of McNeil, and Pierce County and other jurisdictions in Pierce County are starting to feel the brunt of that pressure, and so they are putting up they're vocalizing their resistance to more placements. So now there's an increased interest on the part of the state to try to get these people placed closer to where they originally actually come from.
So is this attachment E? That's an attachment. There's a comparison of populations and prisoners admitted. Prisoners released. Was that an attachment to the comment letter?
Yes, it was one of this. It was a report submitted by one of the public commenters.
I think one of the overall concerns that the department has had through this, because as we've kind of been the tip of the spear to a certain extent, is that we're trying to make sure that we really stay in our lane on this, that it's really about neighborhood compatibility and safety of the structures for the residents as well as the staff that are there. As it is so highly charged emotionally, I think a lot of people want to kind of drag us into other aspects of it, including law enforcement. Like, what are you going to do if there's a violation? And it's kind of like, that's not in our wheelhouse, that's in yours, and those kinds of things. So, you know, it is, we recognize there's a lot of kind of issues that surround this for communities to have to kind of work through. And so we're trying to take this step in terms of, you know, the existing neighborhoods and the community character that we have out there now, and still try and make sure that as these facilities get located, it's done in a responsible and safe manner.
So on any level, are there regulations that address things like staffing ratios and that sort of thing, or is it just kind of freewheeling?
Those are done by the court. In fact, okay. We've, you know, given this kind of suite of conditions that are placed on it, it really does seem as though, and this observation was made by one of the commissioners, that, you know, it almost seems like depending on the quality of representation that any one of these people has is going to determine the conditions under which they're, you know, placed. And it's really the advocates or the representatives of the folks who are being released from these facilities who have, I mean, they're the ones that propose the location, they find the location, and they work out the arrangements, and then it's DSHS and Department of Corrections that actually goes out and assesses those suggested or recommended locations for placement. And so, you know, depending on how aggressive or committed a representative may be for one of these folks may have a lot to do with the type of facility or the location that they're placed in.
I have some commercial entities jumped in to fill this need for these facilities. I noticed some material, COSA.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a new business model.
That's what I was thinking. Somebody's going to be making some money.
Yeah. And, you know, for me personally, reading the court orders for some of these folks has been kind of eye-opening because when you look at the level of restrictions that these people are under, short of total confinement, this is about as restrictive of a lifestyle as I can possibly imagine.
Any other questions or anything that would be helpful moving forward to the public hearing in terms of information that can be provided?
I'm not sure it would be helpful, but I still get kind of stuck on this concept. It's kind of been mentioned here many times that the people who are in these least restrictive environments that are basically locked up, and I relate back to a personal story, which I college student wandered the hillsides in California with a group of maybe 15 or so murderers and rapists. But they were like 60, 70 years old. And we still, I felt no fear there because they were from the men's colony jail. They were incarcerated, but released to do this. Now, if I told anybody, I told my mother I was on the hillside with murderers and rapists, she'd have freaked. But it didn't bother me. And these people who are locked in these confinements at this point, from the way I understand it, I don't have fear of them. I have concern for a lot of other things that are related to this. But I'm just wondering if there's a way to communicate that to the people who have such fear.
And that would be, I would think, ideal from coming from the state.
And that was exactly the point in the neighborhood meeting requirement, and for the broad range of notification that is required in the draft. In the draft, that half mile notification radius that mirrors the radius that the sheriff's office uses for all placements, not just placements to these group facilities. But this has been, you know, as Jim said earlier, this has been kind of a learning experience for everybody that kind of sticks their nose under the tent and tries to figure out what's going on. And speaking for myself, my own learning on this has evolved greatly. And yes, I think you're correct that there are other placements that might be more worthy of concern. We have little latitude, if any, to do anything about that. But our hope with the neighborhood meetings is that we can better inform the community of just how secure these facilities are, what is in them, how they operate, what the requirements are, and if that means bringing somebody from DSHS or Department of Corrections to help explain that, that's fine. But the hope is to educate the community a little bit better so everybody can be processing this more based on knowledge than on fear.
Would they really all be the same, though? Because the way you've described it, each person has their own tailor-made restrictions, so they would not necessarily all be the same.
They are not necessarily all the same, and that's one of the things that makes this more challenging is one of these facilities can be placed in a neighborhood and can be placed according to the risk potential activities. The facility can take that into consideration, but all the people who are placed there by the court are placed there after the facility is established. So there's a presumption that a placement in the facility will fit the kind of neighborhood fabric for all those risk potential activities, and we have really no way to validate that. One of the reasons why we mirror the language of the state in the that addresses risk potential activities is so that way is because there have been some documented failures by the state to consider to fully consider them, and we wanted to mirror it in county code, so that way the county has a mechanism potentially to address it if there is a what I would describe as an ill-placed someone who's not suited to the location for whatever reason.
Are state agency people going to be invited to attend the hearing on May 7th? Or has their lack of responsiveness, has that been an indication that they just as soon not be a part of this process? Or I would think it would be helpful to have representation from certain state agencies.
We haven't had state agencies participate, but we have had representatives and advocates for some of the placements, including placements that are currently in the Poulsbo location. I think just one other point to add on to Dave's is that each of these folks has the ability to petition the courts to be reevaluated on an annual basis, and so the conditions under which their initial placement may be made can actually be modified over time. So there are examples where you could start off and you could be, you know, have to be chaperoned on all of your external, you know, visits or trips. But then over time, if you've documented that you are kind of staying within the boundaries, that you can have that restriction lessened over time as well. And so
that individual wouldn't have to leave that facility that provides that level of security. The facility itself would have to modify its approach to that individual if their restrictions were lessened.
Yes.
Okay. I mean,
presumably that would happen unless the restrictions then allowed it for a family member and is now willing to accept that person as a placement in their house. I mean, one of the things is given the number of folks who are waiting for placement right now, effectively what happens is I think once one of these, you know, kind of more group-like facilities becomes established, if somebody were to move out because they're not under the same level of or need of enhanced services, that somebody else will likely get placed into that facility once it's established. So thinking these are going to be kind of ephemeral elements of the community is probably not necessarily accurate.
Yeah, I think that the locked nature of the facility provides a level of comfort for the community. I'm interested in knowing whether within the individuals within a locked facility, once they no longer are required to have that restriction, they can now move about freely in the community. Will the locked facility be letting them out and in, or would it be safer to say that they would transition?
I was trying to figure out too.
Well, I want to address two things. Number one is there's also a flip side to what Jim described in terms of lessening of requirements, and that's that people, there is a track record of some individuals who have violated their terms and then end up going back to McNeil. So it's not, that's not a one-way street. What we have been told is that the likelihood of these people actually being able to freely roam is highly unlikely. If by nothing else than the fact that they have such a mental disability that they just can't function like an average person would. They just don't have the life skills that an average person would.
All right. On that note, we will continue to move forward then with the public hearing on May 7th. Don't be surprised if the draft that comes before you might have some additional tweaks, but we will do our best to highlight those for you as it moves forward through the process. And if you have any questions, please feel free to get them to the clerk, and we'll be happy to answer them.
And don't be surprised if it's a long evening.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Liz. This has been very, very helpful. I think was a good presentation, good discussion. And with that, we'll move on to Mr. Bulger's administrative update.
Sure, just one newsworthy event, and that is that the department has a new director. Jeff Remack, our chief building official, was named by the board at the end of March. He officially took over duties on April 1st, and I'm sure he would have been here to introduce himself directly, but he is off in Hawaii on a previously planned vacation, and I don't think anybody was going to be able to prevent him from taking advantage of that. So I'm sure he'll be here at the next meeting to introduce himself. So
very good. With that, is there anything else for the good of the order? All right, with that, we will adjourn.
Thank you.